Tonight on Arena, we bring you a Harry Potter special as we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the publication of The Philosopher's Stone, the first ever Harry Potter book. We'll be exploring the world of Hogwarts with its witchcraft and wizardry both on the page and on the screen, and analysing the alchemy at work in J.K. Rowling's acclaimed series. We'll also announce our choice of the best line from the series as nominated by you, the listeners to Arena. Our panel this evening, who I did hope would be in dressed as their particular favourite Harry Potter character, but they've all disappointed me. Dara Dance, Stephanie Prisner, Harvey O'Brien and Etna Shorthall. Etna, you first came to read Harry Potter. You was a bit into the series, but you were exactly the same age as Harry.
As Harry, which I think gives me an affinity. So two books were out by the time I had read it, and the third book was coming out that year, which was 1999. So basically the series starts and he's 11. In 97. I was 11 in 97. So then by the time I read the first two, I was 12. Then I was 13 for the third one, 14 for the fourth one. But then obviously J.K. Rowling got distracted by the millions that she was making, and the gaps between the books kind of lengthened to, I think there was 3 years.
And the books got longer
And the books got longer.
Yeah. She was probably writing.
She was writing, like, but I also think, I don't know, I feel like poverty must have driven her on at the beginning. But I forgive it. But so I was older by the time he sort of finished up his journey. But even though I was older, like I was finished college by the time the last book came out, but I still remember lying to a friend that was over that evening saying I didn't feel well just so I could go to bed and finish it. So like I grew up.
So this was somebody who was visiting your house?
Yeah, and I actually said I didn't feel well. So I was living at home with my parents at the time, and Porrick is his name, and he was visiting, and I said, yeah, I don't feel well, I'm going to go to bed, and I just left him sitting downstairs talking to my parents, and I just had to get upstairs and finish it. And like the tears in the last book as well, I had to keep taking breaks and put it down so I could wipe my eyes and, you know, get myself together again.
And in your case, Stephanie, were you there from the very outset? You would have been a bit younger than Harry as you were reading.
I was 2 years younger than Harry, and that always made me feel like I would eventually achieve, like it was okay that I wasn't where he was at because I was 2 years younger than him. But I was famed for being the girl who brought Harry Potter to Mallow, which is a very, very big claim, well, I think. But
that is like the title from a Harry Potter book itself.
I know, right?
The boy who lived, the girl who brought Harry Potter to Mallow.
I know we're all excited about Harry Potter. There are four of us in studio, including and myself makes five. So let's try to let each person have their say and do laugh and have fun, but let them speak. Go ahead. The girl who brought Harry Potter to Mallow.
Yes.
On the train?
No, not on the train. We used to go to Cork. My mum and I used to go to Cork every Saturday from Mallow, which is like 30-minute commute. And she would get her hair done. And we had to walk past a toy shop and a bookshop. And across from the hairdressers that she went to, Darcy's, is Waterstones. And in the toy shop, I'd be like, can I have this? Can I have this? Can I have this? And she'd say, no, no, no. But when we got to the bookshop, she made a decision when I was very young that if I ever asked for a book, she would say yes. And I didn't ask for that many books. But one day anyway, I remember she was getting her hair dyed, and that was always a lengthy sit down in the hair salon.
Time for a big book.
So she let me pick a book, and so I was only as high as the third shelf, and there was these three red books all the same, and they were called Harry Potter, and no one had ever heard of it. I didn't know what the hell this was. So I took a book, and I remember devouring it in the hair salon while she was getting her hair dyed. And then I brought it home back to Mallow, and I went to school and I went to swimming. That's... and I was like, you have to get this book. And so many people asked in the Mallow bookshop that she got it in.
You don't need
to thank JK, you can thank me.
You were a little older than Harry, by the longest stretch of the imagination, Harvey.
I was 26, I suppose, when the first book came out. But I didn't encounter them, I think, until the publication of The Goblet of Fire. I was aware of them. I kind of knew there was something going on in the culture. I remember being in the States in a bookshop and seeing...
Goblet of Fire was book number four.
Book number four. I remember seeing The Prisoner of Azkaban. I remember seeing the cover and kind of going, oh yeah, Harry Potter. I really should read those. I keep hearing that name. It's going to be something at some point.
And then you found the excuse of having a nephew.
No. That was later. Oh, no, that was much later. Oh, God, no. No, when I came back then and Goblet of Fire was out in hardback, I got a box set, basically, of the three paperbacks of the first ones. Right. And I said, right, I'm going to have a go at this. And I devoured those first three books. I flew through them. I said, these are really enjoyable, fantastic page turners. I want to see what happens next. And at that point, I was hooked. So I bought the Goblet of Fire in hardback. And then after that, that was when the nephew excuse came along. And it wasn't an excuse. It was brilliant. We went to the midnight launches all the time, and I was able to get the book book with him. We'd go back to his mother's place and we'd sit down and he'd start turning the pages and I'd start turning the pages. Who's going to read more first? And it was fantastic. And I completely, absolutely had no problem being part of that world
and
in my 30s.
Yeah, absolutely. So three unapologetic fans. Dara Downes, you were dubious in that it was not love at first sight.
There's always one, isn't there? I was 8 when the first Harry Potter came out, metaphorically speaking. I was working as a special needs assistant in a primary school in Dublin and the kids kept going on and on. They were like 10, 11, 12 and they were going on and on about this Harry Potter thing. They were going gaga about the thing. And I picked one up and we started reading it out in class. You know, this was started thing. I loathed Philosopher's Stone, just loathed. I didn't go near Harry Potter for several years. Then I was doing an MPhil and I read the whole series and I loathed the series. But then this year something very weird happened. I was teaching a module for the MPhil in Children's Literature in Trinity and one of the module was the school story and I kind of, the obligatory Harry Potter text was on there. And one of our students wrote an essay on narrative technique in the school story and included a close reading of a Quidditch match from the first book. And I was absolutely gobsmacked by all the things that Rowling was doing that I hadn't noticed before. So I went back and reread the series.
You are now
and
a convert.
I'm now a qualified convert. I've mellowed hugely towards it, literally in the last few months.
All right, well, let's have a listen.
This is the sound of humble pie being eaten live on air, Sean.
Let's have a listen to you, because you chose an extract, in fact, from the very first book, The Philosopher's Stone, the one that was published 20 years ago. And we are going to hear that extract. Very important character we're going to meet here. And the reader here is Cathy Rose O'Brien. Cathy Rose O'Brien there reading from Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. With me in studio this evening we have Harvey O'Brien, Dara Downes, Etna Shorthall and Stephanie Prizer, all of them big Harry Potter fans. Dara Downes just in recent months has become that. The whole boarding school setup, and now we're going to get into the psychoanalysis of why you liked them, Harvey. The boarding school, you attended a boarding school.
Yes, I attended a boarding school.
Nothing like Hogwarts.
It was not in the slightest bit magical. Being whipped with towels is not magical. I went to a boarding school in Tipperary.
And I would guess a single-sex boarding school.
Yes, oh, absolutely. Single-sex boarding school still is today, CCR. And, the experience of being cut off from your family and sort of forcibly integrated with a new peer group when you've had a peer group. So say when you've gone to primary school and you knew everybody and then suddenly you're thrown into a whole new school where you're meeting people from all over the country, it's really alienating and you begin to learn how to survive in it by understanding differences between individuals. And I think that's something that is replicated in the experience that Harry has in the novels, in somebody who comes to understand there's a much bigger world out there that he is actually part of, but he doesn't even know he's part of it. And in fact, he knows he's extremely famous in that world. He comes to try to deal with that. So this idea of a changing of environment.
Parents, isn't that it?
Yes, his parents are famous and the idea that his mother died to save his life and he's the only person who ever survived an attack by Voldemort is what provides the novel with its nemesis and its hero. But the experience of separation, which is part of an experience of growth and maturation, is central to the way in which the books work. I mean, the arc of the books overall is growth, maturation and death. And unlike quite a lot of children's book series, which more or less repeat the same things over and over again, Rowling uses repetition points, but across an arc that continually gets deeper and darker as you move along.
You would say that arc goes right across the seven books.
Absolutely. And it goes with each year of his experience at school. So again, as somebody who's been to a boarding school, and again, each year you sort of realise new truths about oneself in that kind of confined environment.
I mentioned the fact that you were at a single-sex boarding school, which I think probably all boarding schools are in Ireland, or 99% of them, I would guess. In this case, in Hogwarts, no, not that. And the trio at the centre of all of the books, Stephanie, Harry, Hermione Granger and Ron Weasley. How important is that dynamic? And the fact that we have two fellas and a girl.
Yeah, I think that also it's really funny just listening to Cathy Rose reading that and also reading the books and then seeing the films. I was so surprised when her name was Hermione because all of the names and all of the spells exist in your head. And I was like, what is Hermione? And what is Alohomora? Like, you just hear all these things.
Because you don't have to say it out loud.
Also, in the fourth book, when Crumb comes, one of this Bulgarian guy that comes, Goblet of Fire, and he's taking part in the competition, Hermione explains how to pronounce her name. And it's written in the book, Hermione. That's the phonetical spelling that Rowling puts out. But she's not called Hermione. She's called Hermione. What's that about? That's blew my head. Anyway, sorry. Go on.
But sorry, the three. So the trio thing is like three is a difficult number to be friends with in life, and also as a wizard, like, you know. So it's true to life, and I think she deals with it really well because the. You know, there's always going to be like the testosterone battle between the two guys. And then they're 11 at the start. They're so small. And then all of a sudden we come back. I think it's probably in the Goblet of Fire, maybe in the fourth book. And all of a sudden they've hit puberty. And all of a sudden Hermione's there. And they're like, oh, hey. And they don't quite know how to deal with it. But and then they also have this Horcrux thing, which... For those of you who don't know what a Horcrux is, it's this when you split your personality into split yourself into seven parts so that you can live forever. And if you wear somebody else's Horcrux, it basically turns you into a bit like a horrible person. And they become horrible to each other when they're wearing these things. And so their friendship is constantly under different struggles. Just as it is, that was something that was really true to life as you're reading it, those fights that you have with your best friends, but how you know they're always going to come together.
In fact, let's have a listen to go to one of the films. I think you had chosen this clip, Etna. It's in Goblet of Fire. And they don't go to school dances in Hogwarts.
No.
They go to balls, of course. What's the dynamic here?
So this is when the hormones have kicked in. And like I said, I was...
Just think, take the eye out of Hermione. What are you left with?
What do you mean?
Hermione.
Oh, no, that's my bad spelling. Ignore it. I thought it was hormone.
But like I was saying, being the same age as Harry, I guess was developing hormones around the same time. But I actually think I must have been a bit earlier because around book three, I was like, come on, someone's got to kiss someone. But anyway, that finally arrived. No. Oh, God. No, I loved it. I was like, more of this. Though. Everything is better with a bit of a romance in it.
Disagree.
So anyway, this will be proof that it's correct because here they are at the fourth one and Ron is into Hermione, but he doesn't...
Ron Weasley, the other part of the trio we've been talking about.
But he can't admit it to himself and Hermione's taken the eye of Crumb, this visiting Bulgarian wizard, and, you know, it's all...
No. All right, let's have a listen to how the conversation ensues then. Don't like their music choice at this ball. Oh, the voice of reality there. That's Ron Weasley as Rupert Grint and Emma Watson as Hermione Granger. I know, lads, that both of you are very quiet around the idea of romance, etc.
I said nothing. Look, it's over here. There's this violent disagreement on the other side of the table. So I'm just going to stay here quite quietly. As I said, I was 26 when these things came out, right?
You were a little past
hormones
the worry.
Hormones were sorted out. We were okay on this, you know, so didn't bother me either way. I mean, yeah, the romantic tension between the characters is really important. And again, it's important from the point of view of that story arc that when it does kick in from those novels, and again for people who grew up at the right age, it must have been an amazing experience to see it being rationalized for you in this way. When I was a kid, like, I was reading The Famous Five and we had to deal with George and we didn't know quite what to do with her, and the sort of absence of any kind of sexual chemistry was as confusing as anything else. So I think it was a great part of the series to go in that direction.
But I suppose when, like, that is one small aspect of this series, we're really talking about big morals, bigger themes, darker tales.
Well, I would argue that the way to kind of explain what Rowling has pulled off with the whole series is she's given us, in many ways, a very traditional boarding school story plus magic plus co-ed.
The co-ed is important.
It's massively important. Apart from anything else, it increased readership massively. I mean, I was talking to my 11-year-old niece just the other day about Harry Potter and what's your favourite part of Harry Potter? Instantly, Hermione. Her role in this for female readers, young female readers, I think it was absolutely massive. And I remember feeling quite uncomfortable in the first couple of books with how Hermione was being treated. It was almost like an anti-feminist thing of, you know, to be a strong, independent thinking young girl, you become a kind of she's parodied as a swat and this and that. But Rowling takes it to a very interesting place. I think the thing that I've always scratched my head over, I'm literally scratching my head, is why not Harry and Hermione? as the romance.
I think she did say that she regretted that not being the case. That it was Ron in the end.
I mean, I do think usually...
Sorry if we've just spoiled it and somebody who's halfway through alert. Book six.
On the 20th anniversary of the books, yeah.
It does usually end up being the best friend, like your main character ends up being the best friend who gets the girl in those dynamics, like such as Dawson's Creek, another pop culture of the same age. But like it had that same which one will end up, and it's not Dawson it's that not ends Dawson. Up with Joey.
I suspect Grange, everyone's been looking for literary kind of predecessors for this. And, and there are Mallory Towers, St. Clair's on the girls' fiction, the girls' boarding school side, and you've got the Billy Bunter kind of thing, or Tom Brown's School Days. I think Grange Hill is here in the background somewhere. The dynamics between Ron and Hermione in particular feels like Tucker and Trisha Yates.
And to broaden it out from, you know, the popular culture area, what about Roald Dahl? What about Tolkien? Does it fit in? In fact, I think you think we're in the world of Dickens in some ways here, Dara.
Hogsmeade there's a culture and nostalgia here for a Victorian village. It's a pre-modern village. It's the place where there are absolutely no Muggles. Hogwarts is an old-fashioned school. I don't think this is actually for Rowling about cultural nostalgia as the nostalgia for a time when a certain type of writing was current. My own theory on this is that the Dickensian, the very English Dickensian humour and the kind of the anarchic behaviour and the caricature, that tradition went underground in adult fiction in the early 20th century, and it only re-emerged in children's fiction. Roald Dahl and even Rowling, David Walliams, for me, they are an extended tribute act to Dickens by any other name.
Are you doubting this?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying, I mean, it's very, I don't have the same sort of critical evaluation of Harry Potter, but I think the Lord of the Rings comparisons are very on the surface. Like, I mean, Dumbledore is Gandalf, you know, Dobby is
Gollum.
You know, there are a lot of...
Well, it's not either or.
I do see a lot. I mean, I have no problem with that whatsoever, but I do see a lot of parallels between those two.
But
series.
Linguistically and in terms of the mythologies at play, I think.
And the choice of names, there's a cat called Cruikshanks. Cruikshank was Dickens' illustrator. But I think there's all sorts of little gestures.
You would say
it's
a very surface comparison, I think,
I think The Lord of the Rings comes from an entirely different place as a work of writing, coming from that, you know, Tolkien was a linguist. And so he was basically inventing an Elvish language and then trying to put a culture around that language. What kind of world produces these words? And it's a completely different approach to that, sort of taking a story structure like a Campbellian story structure of story arc, characters, etc., and just telling the story. I agree with you that there's a richness in her use of language that's quite Dickensian as opposed to what it was that Tolkien was doing.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think Tolkien's writing and Rowling's writing are just completely different worlds.
Let's go back to the writing, actually, and let's have another reading. You chose Stephanie from Half-Blood Prince, which is book number 6.
Yeah.
Why this particular section that you want us to listen to?
This is the section... Oh, yes. I wanted us to listen to this section because I think that more and more Harry Potter, you can read it or view it as something like Voldemort and his Dementors and his Death Eaters, and the fight that Dumbledore talks about is something that is becoming more and more real in our own world. And I think as the books progress and JK was writing in a world that was under the influences and the pressures of international terrorism more and more, she didn't have to do all of the explaining that she did at the start of like what a Dementor is or what a Death Eater is. There isn't, you know, reams of explanation as to the terror that the Wizarding World is under. You know, the Death Eaters come and they blow up London Bridge and then you know exactly where you're at because we have those experiences in that shorthand. And I think that reading them now as a, you know, Voldemort, I mean, he literally rounds up the Muggles. Like, it's very blatant. Like, he is a racist and he does not want anyone who isn't the same as him. So let's round them up and kill them. And reading it in that way is very frightening in this day and age. But also, if you haven't read Harry Potter as, you know, the battle of good against a tyrant, then doing so is not a lot.
All right, well, let's have a listen to the section then that you're talking about. This is from Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And once again, the reader is Kathy Rose O'Brien. I beg your pardon. Cathy Rose O'Brien there, reading from Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, the 2005 publication. It struck me there, and when we heard the first reading, the one that you had chosen, Dara, from The Philosopher's Stone, just how visual the writing is, never mind the films, like the descriptions that you get, the way the tear is rolling out of the eye, and the characters looking across at Ginny. I mean, it is extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, and this is what has converted me to the Rowling cause.
The visual side of it.
It's that, and it's her ability to make it look easy. I mean, this is what that Quidditch match essay did. It really opened my eyes to this.
This is your student's essay.
Her ability to, the choices she's making that you don't even see her making. So she decides, her narrator is one second in Harry Potter's head, the next moment somewhere else. And she's doing this with great, great elegance. And it's extremely difficult to pull off. And contrary to, I think, popular myth, writing for children is more difficult than writing for adults.
She invented a sport. Like, she invented a world, these people, but like Quidditch is a full-on thing.
She's a natural, she's not just a natural storyteller, she's a natural writer in the sense that I genuinely think you cannot write this way unless you are in your mind's eye, this action is unfolding like a home movie. You can't fake this over 7 books.
Well, we're going to head towards the movies in the second part of the programme, and to help us get there, John Williams realised the visual world with his music, amazingly.
Harvey. I mean, John Williams has been the go-to guy for fantasy, science fiction, adventure since the 70s. And you would have thought that by 2001 that, you know, he might have had nowhere else to go with it. But he managed to come up with a central theme for Harry Potter that has become a leitmotif for 21st century fantasy. And it still resonates the minute that you hear that primary main theme being played by any orchestra. He farmed out the second one to another composer who used his themes. And then he came back in again for The Prisoner of Azkaban, which is probably one of the best scores, in my opinion, in the series. It's really wildly experimental and jazzy. The night bus sequence in that is this crazy percussive sequence of noises, which when I went to the RTE Concert Orchestra a couple of years ago, David Brophy conducted it. I was blown away by hearing it live. So Williams created a new John Williams soundscape, and that's stunning.
Yeah, funny you should mention David Brophy.
Funny I should.
Yeah, because do you know who we spoke to about the score?
Who?
We spoke to David Brophy about the score. And he explained, he very interesting here, brings you through the whole Hedwig theme and explains what's happening musically within it.
You hear it initially on Celeste. It always gives the impression of being a music box. And this notion of boxes that are opening and possibly have magic inside them or something, secrets contained inside them, I think plays into the sort of the feeling or the mood of the Harry Potter films themselves. And then the opening theme you hear, ba-dee-da-da-dum, ba-dee-dum, that to me like sounds like a sort of an old, almost English folk tune. It's not written in the past 20 years. This is music that comes from a couple of hundred years ago. So you do get the sense of the past and history and I suppose the heritage around Hogwarts and this sort of old world music is sort of in that opening idea, that theme. Because it has a sort of a jig-like rhythm, it has a sort of a pastoral feel, so you get the sense of this is not urban music, but it's more countryside music. And when you think of, you know, Hogwarts and its beautiful setting in the countryside in the middle of nowhere, where things happen that nobody else knows about, that's all sort of really interesting stuff, and that's all, the theme music sort of plays into that a lot. But the tune then doesn't go the way you expect. There's a couple of twists in it. So So ba dee da da dum ba dee da ba da da dee ba bum. There's a sort of a strange note in there. And when you hear that strange note, you sort of go, okay, things aren't as they seem here. And I suppose that makes the ear curious. There's a second part of that theme. Ba-dee-da-da-da-da-da-deem. Those three notes I sang. Da-da-deem. They're mystery notes. Things feel a bit creepy in those notes. And those three notes are used over and over again in different contexts. So in a quicker music, it goes bum 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 bum. Those notes keep coming back over and over and over again. Not like a leitmotif, but sort of as a motif that comes back over again. But they're used very effectively in the Harry Potter films. And that's just the melodic content. You then think of the orchestration. So after the Celeste plays that opening theme, you've got these crazy scales in the first and second violins. These, all you can call them, like, is whirling motions of demi-semi-quavers that fly around in the middle of this theme. And immediately it conjures up ideas of a magic wand waving and moving cloud formations in the sky or ideas wafting around a simple thematic idea. And that creates a sense of magic in itself. And then, of course, when you think of like the landscape and the great enormity of the challenges that Harry himself takes on through the whole course of the film, you couldn't but think of a symphony orchestra, you know. And for me anyway, as a conductor, an orchestral conductor, I find it heartening to know that there are generations of kids who have grown up with an orchestra soundtrack at the back of their minds, and they've probably came across that soundtrack through the Harry Potter films.
Little section there from John Williams' score to the Harry Potter movies. That's Hedwig's theme, and it was David Brophy that you heard talking about it. We'll be back with more from Harvey O'Brien, Dara Downs, Edna Shortall and Stephanie Preisner after this break. 27 minutes to 8 o'clock on Friday night's Arena, and we're talking Harry Potter right through the programme this evening. With me in studio, Harvey O'Brien, Dara Downs, Edna Shortall and Stephanie Preisner. And yes, we will be discussing lots of plots and twist turns and some things that happen late on in the series. So, you know, be aware of that if you are listening to us this evening. We've been speaking mostly about the books, really, in part one, but let's get into the film world now. Mm. You're the casting director. You have to find somebody to play Harry Potter, because that's kind of where you're going to start, I would have thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Daniel Radcliffe, was he on a hiding to nothing from the outset?
It was, look, here's the problem. I mean, inevitably with children's literature, the central character has to be bland enough that a child reading it can empathise with and identify with them, so they're not too distinct. So inevitably, whoever was put into the role of Harry Potter was going to become a distinct individual, because they were physically present, and so you were going to look at them, and they were going to be, okay, young, but nonetheless an actor at that point in their very young career. And so Radcliffe was always going to be, to some degree, the target of a certain amount of scepticism. Well, he's not my Harry, or something like that. And in the early films, certainly both Emma Watson and Rupert Grint seemed stronger as actors, because they were freer to engage the characters. Exactly. Mm. They were slightly better parts because they weren't the central character in the story, and they were also able to engage them more fully and become and define them. So Radcliffe came in for a fair amount of at least criticism, but people were still conscious of the fact that you are talking about a kid who was himself 11 at the time.
Yeah.
And so by the time the series got into maybe its third or fourth, people were starting to come around and say, actually, he's doing a pretty good job. He is coming along with this, and he is the age he is, speaking to people of the age he is, as Harry Potter, as much as Daniel Radcliffe.
In fact, I think you were very disappointed with Daniel Radcliffe initially, Stephanie, were you?
I wasn't very disappointed, that's very harsh, but I was... You know, there was all these rumours like, oh, his mother's a casting director. He just got the role. Like as though I myself should have been asked to play Harry. But, you know, you live with these characters in your brain, and they look like something, and they sound and they have different names, and you pronounce things differently. And then all of a sudden you have this little twerp who just, you know, throw on a pair of glasses and he's meant to be Harry, and he was bland, but that allowed me
you,
to...
Remember, the first film was 2001, so you were well into the series at this stage in terms of the reading of it. You were up as far as The Goblet of Fire, which is book four. Yes. So you had four books down before you got the first film.
And then you see him and he was, like, even looking back now when you watch the first film again, they're so small. Like, he's just so tiny, and I was so hard on him.
Yeah.
But, like...
He didn't get much taller.
He didn't.
That's mean.
Remember when the fourth film came out and all of a sudden he had, like, his voice had broken and he had facial hair and you were like, who is this man? Like, there was definitely these big chasms between when the films came out where he had aged on set and you were like, whoa.
Mike Newell talks about that in directing The Goblet of Fire. He said it was like trying to shoot a moving target because he kept changing physically so much in the course of the film that depending on what scene it was, he might look a little younger than he had in the previous scene.
And then Neville Longbottom.
Yeah, like, well, apparently several of the kids, the young boys, they were like, they would have to shave twice a day to kind of keep that look by the time they'd gotten into the fourth film, Goblet of Fire.
There's great pathos in the books. There's great pathos in the phenomenon of this generation of young readers growing up with the books. And then there's huge pathos in the films themselves, because there is a creature that undergoes this mysterious, spooky process where they're metamorphagi, really. Mm. They actually transmute into a different animal altogether. It's called puberty. Mm. And the books are, I think, dramatising this. And that's part of the unspoken drama of the things. And the films really brought that home, I think.
Do you know what I actually want to listen to? Brendan Gleeson, actually, at this point, because he worked with Mad-Eye Moody, and that was a character that he played later on. And he talks in this clip, he was speaking to us about Hampstead last week, and Sinead Mooney, who was in with him, asked him about the whole Harry Potter arrangement and how he even came to become involved in the first place. His children were reading them. Brendan Gleeson was himself a teacher. All of it fed into his decision to do the film and the way he played the character.
Initially, I remember the lads really pressed me, my sons really pressed me into doing it when they heard that that might be a possibility. But when I read the script first, I was going to say, what's about this guy that you really like? So they marked all the stuff in the books out for me. It was a really lazy way of doing it. But I read through that and I said, okay, I can see why they would want me to do that, but it's not in the script. So I had a chat with Mike Newell about it. I said, look, there's kind of everybody in Harry Potter's kind of in loco parentis a little bit, but I don't have enough in this to do it. So we kind of went at things where it became an important character to play in the sense of Harry's need for father figure and stuff like that. Because he's loads of them, but he seems to have no end of need for them. And then the thing about the teaching started to come in. And the fact that Alistair Mad-Eye Moody is like the maddest of the kind of teachers that we would have had in primary school. And the fact that I was a teacher myself kind of said, there was a little bit of fantasy living. Wouldn't it be great to be able to peg dusters at people? So I threw, it was really funny, and I threw a piece of chalk. And of course, it was a shame, the Irish lad was the only one who kind of got it, you know what I mean? He copped on. But it was like so regressive, it was just kind of hilarious. And the kids were not spoiled and they weren't little horrors, they were just brilliant. I was told not to get, you know, Daniel giggling or that he wouldn't stop. And of course, that's like red rag to a bull. Of course, you're going to make him giggle. But they were then to be swept off to school and they had to put in the school hours and they were kept on their feet. And they were a lovely bunch. It was great. It was kind of magical, the whole thing.
Brendan Gleeson there on his experience in the Harry Potter movies. I love the detail of the chalk. It was only the Irish kid who understood. But I suppose it gives us a sense there that they have international appeal. They aren't. How has she managed that? Because in some ways, you know, when you hear words like Quidditch, Hogwarts, it's so quintessentially English and British, but it goes right across. It seems to have international appeal, Stephanie.
It does have international appeal, and also there's the, you know, it is quite arresting when the other wizards come to Hogwarts for the Triwizard Tournament.
Yeah.
And so then there's like these Bulgarian wizards and these French wizards. And I often wonder, like, is there only one British school of witchcraft and wizardry, or what is the story there? And then Fantastic Beasts came out, which is another book or film. And in that one, she says they call, so in Harry Potter, they call people who don't have any magic muggles. But in America, in Fantastic Beasts, they say, in America, we call them nomadge, as in no magic.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, wow, there's this whole, like, there's a whole world that has all of the things that our world has, like colloquialisms. Yeah, sorry.
And when we read them, I suppose reading that as children, you just read the characters, you're not even looking at nationality, I would guess. When we read them as adults, however, we might start to put some sort of different reading on it. You think this is Blair, this is the Blair's United Kingdom in a children's book, Dara?
I think this, first of all, the Americans go wackadoodle for bottled Britishness, and the the stateside success was a major reason why it went even further. I mean, it was so successful there. It's an old version of Britain. I think, again, I'm bored about this, but it's the Dickensian Englishness being bottled here, and it's the same with so many other writers. But I think there's something. This is the kind of the grumpy day job me talking, where we have to kind of try to decode the ideology going on in a little bit. I think Rowling gets herself into knots with the bloodline ideology stuff, explaining magic through bloodline. It's as though she makes that decision to get her story going and spends the rest of the series feeling very guilty about it or very uneasy about it. Breakfast. She doesn't want to know whether it's. Part of the message of the books is it's meritocratic. The other part is what your inherited bloodline is actually what's going to make the difference.
Did you say she does or doesn't drop it, Stephanie?
She does. There's muggles, there's wizards, there's squibs,
and there's mudbloods,
which is like basic. And the prejudices are across the book. And what I really liked about that was that Ron is basically a racist. He's a racist.
But the whole Hogwarts institution is based on being superior to muggles. And that is a problem. And as well as that, there's this. Now again, this is you have to pardon me because this is the day job. We have to talk about this kind of thing in the academic readings of it. The fact that you have a capitalist economy in the wizarding world. And these are wizards who can make things appear out of nowhere. Why do you have the kind of scarcity that would require these things? It feels to me like when I read these, they capture the zeitgeist of the Blair era, which is of liberal niceness, but behind it, some worrying stuff going on.
Yeah, I do think that that stuff is there in the prejudices, but I think it's there in the real world, and so no more in her books. Like, it's there as a form of racism. I don't really read it like class, you know, like the British classism. I read it like racism. I read it like the things that led to World War II, which is for me the greater sort of comparison with the series. And like Stephanie was saying, like Ron has prejudices at the beginning of the book and is sort of racist, but Ron can sometimes feel like the weakest character, but I think he gets the most out of that friendship. His world is opened up because Hermione comes from muggle parents, and you know he falls for her, but not just that, he sees her as a person and that she's worthwhile, and by the end of the book they're really ultimately defending muggles from bad wizards.
But why is Hermione allowed in the first? It's because the reactivation of the older gene, as it were. I mean I don't think the kind of the meritocratic idea that it's what you do, it's the choices you make rather than who you essentially are.
But muggles aren't wizards.
The big villain of it all, Lord Voldemort, what does he represent? Do you think can we put a name on him?
I'm not sure you see that there's all that much of a fundamental difference in the worldview of a Dumbledore and a Voldemort. The fundamental distinction is between those who have magic and those who are muggles.
Who don't have magic,
and it's the relationship to the muggle world that I just find problematic.
One thing that we haven't spoken about yet that I think is vital to it, Brendan Gleeson touched on it in his little story there where he was talking about this constant search for a father figure. Yeah. It's essential to Harry's arc.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's completely, you know, again, more day job stuff, but it's entirely psychoanalytic. Harry is a child without a father, and, you know, okay, without a mother as well, but the father figure becomes important, and the father represents the law, and understanding moving from the world of the mother to the world of the law is part of the process of growing up, of a child becoming an adult, and that's fundamentally what the whole story is about. And he has to realise how the law functions in a sense in the world, but he also realises that it is dysfunctional because it has in Voldemort an extreme purist, so to speak, from what we've just got, who wants the world to be a very specific way, and Harry enters into that world to essentially become the law. In fact, you know, post story, he becomes head of the Auror department. He is the policeman. He is quite literally the law. And so the inheriting of the father's capacity to make law and to make the world a better place is what Harry is doing in the course of the story. story.
I actually find this fascinating to listen to people talk about it, because maybe it's to do with the age I was when I read it, or maybe it's to do with the fact that I'm not an academic, but I just cannot read Harry analytically. I cannot read the books like that. To me, it's so emotional. It's such an emotional response.
You've said that several times.
I feel really emotional even just talking about them. Like, I was just thinking there, I read the first four books four times, because every time a new one would come out, I would go back and read them all. I never do that now. I don't read a book more than once anymore. And that's the kind of response I had. And it's like, I didn't think about it so deeply when I read. I mean, I did in a different way, very deeply, but it was an emotional, hugely emotional response.
I think we have to be very, very careful. And you see, it's like the first thing, academics, for example, we've absolutely no right to second guess real life child readers who delight in these. We have no right to say you're not allowed to enjoy this. Yeah. The problem is, if you look through the history of children's literature, Rudyard Kipling would write books for children that were full of racist British ideology. If you were to have asked a child in 1895, you know, do you realise that there's all sorts of stuff?
Yeah, they would have said, let's listen to another reading. And this fits in, this was your choice, actually, Etna. So explain a little bit why, because the child that read this from this section from The Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah, so again, like I now know that in the context of this conversation it could be different, but I mainly chose this section because it's when Sirius Black is first introduced, and Sirius is my favourite character in the books. He is, and I he's my favourite because I love him, like not because he stands for anything else, but because I love him. He's introduced in the third book, and initially Harry and everyone else thinks he's a baddie. They think he basically told Voldemort where Harry's parents were and ultimately led to their death, which is not a spoiler, happens at the very beginning of the first book. And we later find out that that was someone else, and that Sirius is a good guy, and he's Harry's godfather, and he looks out for him, and I just think he's a great human, and that's why.
All right, well, let's listen to that section then being read to us for us by Cathy Rose O'Brien, and it's from that third book, The Prisoner of Azkaban. Cathy Rose O'Brien reading from The Prisoner of Azkaban. You were saying how a real emotional attachment or a response to that clip.
Yeah, well, in general, like reading across the whole books, like I remember when I was young, reading them initially, like I was raised by a single mother and I didn't have dad. And I remember that like I also had a lot of mentors and coaches and stuff who I would be very attached to. And I remember like each of Harry's mentors, like Dumbledore and then Sirius and all of the people who he attached himself to, and how he realised that each of them was flawed and how that sort of made him mature and move on to the next one, all the way up until Albus Dumbledore, where we realise the mistakes that he made right at the end. And, you know, I think that was one of JK's really big achievements, was to teach me and other readers that good and evil, like it is not binary. Like the world is not binary. You are good and you are evil, and good people make bad decisions and vice versa.
And I think that's really obvious in Snape. Snape is, I think, the most complex character in the book.
He's unbelievable.
I mean, is he good? Is he bad? He's everything. He's both.
He's double-aged. It's wonderful.
Yeah, he's and actually that's something I probably would read an academic essay on. Like they're trying to get to the very heart of Snape.
Okay, we're hurtling towards 8 o'clock, and I want to round up after this. So we'll come back in a few minutes' time and get your final thoughts. Welcome back to our Harry Potter special celebrating the 20th anniversary of the publication of The Philosopher's Stone, the very first Harry Potter book. With me in studio, Dara Dunn, Stephanie Preisner, Harvey O'Brien, Etna Shorthold. We didn't hear your reading, Harvey, your chosen reading. What did you choose and why?
Yeah, I chose a passage from The Chamber of Secrets, and it's the passage that introduces Gilderoy Lockhart. And I love that character. Maybe, again, it's because I'm an academic. So what we have here is a self-serving media hog who turns up on sort of, you know, talk shows and stuff. And I just love the way, and again, this ties in with exactly what we were saying. It's about challenging your expectations, that somehow the adults know what it's all about. And Gilderoy Lockhart is exactly that character. He comes along and says, oh, I've done this, I've done that, I've done everything, and he writes all these books. And of course, he's a complete liar. And I love the way that she portrays him. And I also cannot now get Kenneth Branagh out of my head, because I think the casting was spot on in the film. I loved the way that Branagh portrayed him. So I love this passage.
Cathy Rose O'Brien there reading from Chamber of Secrets, and that was the reading choice of Harvey O'Brien. Etna, you said to me at the very early on in the programme, you said, are you going to ask us what our favourite book is? But we found out that that's a boring question because the answer is the same from everybody seemingly.
Yeah, Prisoner of Azkaban.
And you said it's not just the four of you.
No, I talked to a journalist for a feature over the week that I think is going to be in the Examiner over the weekend, and he asked me what my favourite book was, and I said Prisoner of Azkaban, and he said everyone he talked to for the feature said Prisoner of Azkaban. I had no idea, but it's when Harry gets a bit darker. The first two books are very much kids' books. Three gets dark, also crucially introduces Sirius Black, as I said, favourite character for me anyway.
And the Dementors.
And the Dementors, yeah.
The moment in the Harry Potter series when you just thought, this is beyond compare, Stephanie.
When you were reading the series,
across the series, the moment when you said, this is the best thing ever, because you think this is a work of literary genius. You have no question in your mind.
Yes, there isn't a specific moment, but I do remember when, and this is a spoiler alert, so turn off your radio, and it's like the biggest one. It was when Cedric Diggory died. I thought, oh my God, like, she's killed Cedric. Anything is possible. This woman doesn't care about my emotions. She is taking this story to wherever she needs it to go, and we are in a different...
And that is when Rowling's killing spree begins. Then she just starts killing people off left, right,
and
centre.
Let Harvey, your best moment in one of the films.
Well, again, I'm a huge fan of both Prisoner of Azkaban as a novel and as a film, and I just love the exact same sequence Ethne picked from the book, from The Prisoner of Azkaban, and partly because of the wonderful actors. So you get to see David Thewlis, Gary Oldman and Alan Rickman face off against one another as English actors as much as anything else, but it's because of the shifting, changing emotions of the scene. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? I love it.
At the moment I realised that these books really were up to something was 2016.
All right.
No, seriously, it's when the Dementors come on the scene in Prisoner of Azkaban. Right. Yeah.
But you did choose a final clip that I think we should, before we round up and give the competition winner, which I will do. It's all about fathers and sons along the way.
This is the moment when we realise that the father that Harry needs is himself.
Oh, now get your hankies out for this one. Oh, there we go. Arthur Bone playing the part of the son there, Albus Severus Potter, and of course it was Daniel Radcliffe as the older Harry there discovering it all. Lots of tears in the eyes. I nearly cried when I heard that earlier on.
That is much better in the books than seeing them trying to make Daniel Radcliffe look like an old man.
All right, two things before we go. First of all, as part of Independent Bookshop Week, from 11 a.m. tomorrow, independent booksellers Debray are celebrating Harry Potter. A treasure hunt in each store, lots of activities and treats. For those who dressed up for the occasion, that's to the four of you who didn't, might put on my own hat for that one. And the winner of the best line, we asked the four of you to debate, and you eventually did come up with a winner. And the winning line is, we must all face the choice between what is right and what is easy. It's said by Albus Dumbledore, and it was Roisin O'Neill from Waterford who is our winner this evening, and she gets a full set of the books, Bloomsbury set of a box set of the entire Harry Potter series. Well, that's it for our Harry Potter special. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking to Dara Downs, Stephanie Preisner, Harvey O'Brien and Etna Shorthall about it all. Elaine Conlon was the broadcast coordinator this evening. Ciarán Dunne was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Moody. Sorry about that, Ciarán. John Creedon is on the way.